Before we had the term serial killer, which is now so ubiquitous, a person was on the loose in Depression-era Cleveland, Ohio, leaving a trail of dismembered bodies. Elliot Ness, the man who brought down Al Capone, was not just an untouchable. His career took a turn when his very next assignment brought him to Cleveland, Ohio, where the torso murderer, the mad butcher of Kingsbury Run, was still on the loose and hacking up bodies. I am Suzanne Lang, and I bring you A Novel Idea. Today we will try not to get too gruesome as we explore the career of Elliot Ness in his post-untouchable years when he was the public safety director in Cleveland, Ohio. In that capacity, he was in charge of the police department and the fire department, and some of his goals were to root out graft and corruption within the police force and to modernize the department with nascent technology like the polygraph. This was in the wake of the Great Depression, and Cleveland was a city coming back with growth and industry. However, Ness's arrival is somewhat simultaneous to the discoveries of bodies, dismembered and decapitated bodies, that indeed gripped the city and gripped the nation with fear and curiosity. Daniel Stashower is a writer who enjoys writing about crime. He has several novels that have brought him praise, but he's found that he loves pursuing historical nonfiction and biography. His work includes The Boy Genius and the Mogul, The Untold Story of Television, The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and The Invention of Murder. The Hour of Peril, The Secret Plot to Murder Lincoln Before the Civil War. And keeping with his affinity toward crime fiction, he has written extensively on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. American Demon, Elliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper is Stashower's expose on the life and career of Elliot Ness amidst the gruesome murders that took place in Cleveland. Bodies that didn't seem to follow a pattern other than in the precision of their dismemberment. A little later in the show, Stashower and I will both talk about our personal connections to this lurid story. Now, hear my conversation with Daniel Stashower. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your book, American Demon, Elliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper. The title says a lot right there and is as sensational as this story is, a story that really surprised me. We have mythic knowledge of Elliot Ness that you really expand upon and break apart. And I want to start out talking about Elliot Ness, but this also is a story about crime and well, before we had the term serial killers, this definitely was that sort of thing that took over the city of Cleveland and other areas for a while. So let's first start with, it seems like you like writing about crime. So what draws you to these type of topics?
Well, I've always been interested in crime. When I was a kid, I liked to read mystery novels, and I particularly liked to read the Sherlock Holmes stories. When I was starting out as a writer, I wrote mystery novels. And then at one stage, I got an opportunity to write a biography of Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. Over the course of writing that book, I discovered that I really enjoyed the research and the history that went into writing nonfiction. And it felt like a natural step from there to gravitate towards writing about true crime. But I tend to focus on historical true crime, things that happened in the fairly distant past, so that there is that historical aspect to it. And I find that fascinating.
And that is the case with this book. There is a lot of deep research, I would say, and you contextualize the story as to what was happening elsewhere in our history at the time. But let's start with Eliot Ness. Eliot Ness is somebody who maybe most of us know about from the television series, which I imagine is still viewable someplace, and also the movie. But you bring a different side of him that is, I grew up in Cleveland and I didn't know that Eliot Ness had a big part of his career happen in Cleveland. So set us up with how Eliot Ness came from Chicago and the Untouchables to be the public safety director in Cleveland, Ohio.
Sure thing. Well, you know, in many ways, Eliot Ness is exactly what you think he was. He was a hero. He was a man of great integrity and bravery. But the fascinating thing for me over the course of looking into his story and writing this book was that he's so much more than the tough guy that we know from TV and the movies. Ness rose to fame during the Prohibition years as the man who got Al Capone. And he's remembered today as the leader of the Untouchables, a legendary team of Prohibition agents. And you mentioned the old black and white TV series, which starred Robert Stack. And a lot of people will have seen the movie with Kevin Costner and Robert De Niro. When people think of Eliot Ness, they usually think of a big truck smashing through the doors of one of Capone's breweries. But the real Eliot Ness was more than that. He was also a very forward-thinking reformer. Yes, he was astonishingly brave, and his exploits were spectacular. But on screen, he generally solved his problems with violence. And in real life, he rarely even carried a gun. In fact, he once told a friend he didn't need it, that the empty holster was enough. And he brought off some of his bravest and most spectacular moments just with that empty holster. It's a very fascinating story. Now, you were asking about Cleveland. Well, we think of Ness as a Chicago guy because that's where all the drama with Al Capone and the Untouchables played out. But what a lot of people don't realize is how brief that chapter of his career was. It was pretty much all wrapped up by the time he turned 30. So he needs a second act. What does he do? He moves to Cleveland. And why not? He landed a job as the director of public safety, as you mentioned. And this was a position that put him in charge of the entire police department and the fire department and a whole lot more. It was a big, big promotion. So big, in fact, that a lot of people assumed he would fall flat on his face. In Chicago, he'd been in charge of a handful of guys. And now in Cleveland, he's in charge of thousands of city employees in one of America's biggest cities. And he's the youngest person ever to hold the position. And his marching orders were to clean up the police department, which was basically rotting from inside out because of corruption, and to try to break the stranglehold that the mob had over the city. At that time, Cleveland was nearly as mobbed up as Chicago. So that's a pretty tall order, clean up the police force and take down the mob. And the wonder of it all is the degree to which he succeeded. As one of his reporter friends said, his timing was terrific. The city had seldom needed a hero so badly.
And he did bring a lot of change to how things were done and sought to modernize the police force. It sounds in some ways rather unglamorous to become a bureaucrat after something as exciting as what was happening in Chicago. And there were a lot of people who wanted to see him fail in a way. What do you think that was all about?
Well, as in Chicago, the city thrived on a system of entrenched payoffs and bribes and shady dealing. And the people who benefited from that, as in Chicago, didn't care to see that disrupted. There were handouts to the police. There were shady public officials, all of whom saw this young upstart, as they saw him, as threatening to the established order, the way things had always been done. One of the journalists in Cleveland at the time would say that Ness's approach to crime was about as emotional as an accountant's approach to double entry booking, meaning he just had this idea of how to clean up the police department. And there was a new reform-minded mayor who believed that the city would never get back on its feet in the aftermath of the Great Depression until it would cleaned up crime. And this was an equation that Ness understood. This was a chance to translate the lessons of the Capone era into real and lasting reform. He once said that in any city where corruption continues, it follows that some officials are playing ball with the underworld. So Ness plunged in. He was kicking down doors. He was closing gambling parlors. He was rousting crooked cops. And he made a particular specialty of taking down crooked precinct captains, an effort that he likened to cutting the head off a snake. And he introduced training and reforms to modernize the force. And all of this, by slow degrees, had the effect of cleaning up the town.
Well, since you just brought up cutting off heads, that's a perfect segue into when Ness arrives in Cleveland. It is somewhat simultaneous to this gruesome discovery over a period of months of dismembered bodies. And as I said, the term serial killer wasn't used, and I think it took a while for law enforcement to start making connections with some of these murders. So why don't you set up the whole discovery of this wave of dismembered bodies?
Well, it's the mid-1930s. This is during the worst years of the Great Depression. And suddenly, in Cleveland, Ohio, there's a string of brutal killings. They're horrible, seemingly without precedent. Each of the victims appeared to have been beheaded. Some, it seemed, while still alive. And the remains, in most cases, were painstakingly dismembered and scattered across the city. So the horror was everywhere. A pair of schoolboys would stumble over a headless torso, or a severed limb would be seen floating in the river, or a skull would be found rattling around in a tin can at a city dump. And each atrocity touched off a cycle of fear and outrage and calls for action in the newspapers. There were headlines like, "The Mad Butcher Strikes Again," or, "Who is this mad torso killer?" One reporter called him that almost unknown creature, a master criminal. And the reporter added that it can be argued powerfully that he was the greatest murderer of all time. But as you say, it took a while before the police realized that they were dealing with a series of related crimes. The killer appeared to be preying on the indigent population of the city. These were people who, in a phrase that got repeated over and over again at the time, these were people who wouldn't be missed. So it took a while before the police and the investigators and the individual crimes realized that they were looking at a series of related horrors.
And the newspapers, I would say they played a pretty good role in your story. And during those times, there were three major papers in Cleveland, Ohio, and they fed a lot of the conversation, the investigation. They seemed like they were a big part of the story.
They certainly were. There were several newspapers operating in Cleveland at that time, and three major ones. And they soon discovered that the butcher, this mad killer, sold newspapers. There was a journalist at the time who wrote, "My God, how that man can sell newspapers." And this escalating cycle of sensationalism began very early on. At the beginning, because of the gruesome nature of the crimes, newspapers like The Plain Dealer, which was the morning paper, struggled to find acceptable language with which to describe some of the dismemberments, the horrible crimes that had been practiced on these victims. There were discrete phrases like otherwise mutilated that were used. They were straining to find language that their readers would not be repulsed by. But as time went on, things got more graphic. The story traveled far and wide, and true crime pulp magazines got in on the act, and the coverage grew increasingly lurid.
I wondered about those true crime magazines. When did they emerge into, I'll call it the popular culture, but when did they emerge as publications?
It goes back centuries in some cases, but for these purposes, what we today remember as the pulp magazines, I've got, you know, some of them here on my desk now with titles like True Detective and Official Detective Stories. And they've got covers like that you remember from magazines, similar in style to magazines like Black Mask, where detective fiction appeared. And they entered into the story fairly early on. And in fact, some of the key figures in the investigation were swept up in the coverage. One of the coroners who worked on this case, a man named Sam Gerber, was commissioned to contribute pieces to one of the magazines. Whether he wrote them or not, I couldn't tell you. And one of these magazines actually also offered a reward for information leading to the arrest of the killer, but on the condition that those details appeared first in the magazine, which of course could have seriously subverted and hampered the course of the investigation. So they became tangled up in the story in a way that had a fairly serious impact very early on.
So we have these murders taking place, and the struggle to investigate. And I was surprised by, even in the 30s, how it seemed like somebody would call the cops and within, you know, a half hour they were there. And there were a kind of a core group of cops working on this. But Elliot Ness seemed to have a sense of remove or remoteness about this, and even developed his own smaller group of inner circle people called the Unknowns that were always conducting some sort of parallel operation or investigation. So many thought that Elliot Ness was kind of missing in action and nabbing the butcher. So talk a little bit about his engagement and on what level that was and why it seemed to many to be so remote.
Well, this is the thing. The Elliot Ness from television would have strapped on his holster and started kicking down doors. That's what you expect when you hear the name Elliot Ness. But the real Elliot Ness is a different guy. And it's important to point out that catching killers was not his job. He wasn't hired to be a homicide detective any more than he was hired as a fireman or a crossing guard. He was the director of public safety. He was at the top of the pyramid. The chief of police reported to Elliot Ness. And nobody expects a director of public safety to solve a murder any more than they expect him to walk a beat or to rescue cats stranded in trees, except when it's Elliot Ness. People did expect action from Elliot Ness. They expected heroics. Ness had made a point of saying that he would lead from the front lines. So over time, as the pattern of these crimes gathered force, he had to step in. So as you mentioned, he put together a team in the mold of the Untouchables. But they worked outside the system. They worked under the radar. They were trying to gather information off the criminal grapevine. That's not to say that Ness ignored the official effort. He devoted extra resources and manpower, but this smaller, hands-on effort was typical of him. It was also how he was addressing police corruption. He was using a small team of men that he could trust, men that he knew had not been touched by corruption or any other type of entanglement with business as usual. He said very little about it publicly, and that contributed to this notion that you mentioned, that he wasn't doing anything at all. But he was. He was working behind the scenes with uncharacteristic reserve. But there was one notable statement that he made to the press. He said, "I'm going to do all I can to aid in the investigation. I want to see this psycho caught."
Yes, and that he used that term, psycho, got my attention.
Absolutely.
So this was also happening at a time when forensic technology was emerging or transforming. So we could talk a little bit about that, but also that the coroner, in examining these remains, they were fairly certain, because of the skill in which this dismemberment happened, that the killer must be either somebody with some sort of medical training or an actual butcher. So that drove them much of the time.
Absolutely. From the beginning, the investigators believed that the killer had knowledge and training that allowed for the surgical precision of the dismemberments that had been performed on the victims. It was a doctor or a butcher. That was the theory. But as we mentioned earlier, it took a while before the police realized that they were dealing with a series of connected crimes. And one of the things that made that snap into focus was this surgical precision of the dismemberments. At one stage, a body was discovered barely a mile away from where two others had been found a few months earlier. And the scale of the thing just came into focus. And an investigator said that he and his detectives were on the trail of a crazed killer with a flair for butchery. But remember, this is the 1930s. Modern forensics, techniques such as criminal profiling, that stuff hadn't happened yet. But even so, the Cleveland police threw everything they had at it, and they even improvised new techniques, trying to push through the limitations of their resources and technology. The coroner brought together a panel of experts to produce what they called a synthetic portrait of the killer. Well, today we would recognize that as criminal profiling. And at another stage, the police went looking for a particular suspect, but they couldn't find a recent photograph. All they had was a photo of this suspect from the age of 12. So they took that image and they projected it onto canvas, and an artist altered and embellished the image to approximate the man's current appearance, which of course reminds you of the age progression software that we have today. The police did their best, but there was this one question that they couldn't answer. And for me, it's best summed up by an article, an editorial in the Cleveland News, one of the three major papers. The editorial said, "What fantastic chemistry of the civilized mind converted this man into a human butcher?" And then is now. That's a very tough nut to crack.
Yes. I couldn't help, while reading the book, to think about how we have seen murder escalate in this country. And I don't know if this episode was the start of it, but it is really a shocking thing, just that we observe in our culture. And I almost feel it's a truly American thing, even though Jack the Ripper was in London. There is something that is so inexplicable about what causes people to do these sorts of acts.
Inexplicable and horrifying. But you mentioned Jack the Ripper, to which these crimes are often compared. A lot of commentary at the time made a great deal out of the fact that this series of crimes in Cleveland overlapped with the 50th anniversary of the Ripper's crimes in London. And a lot of the coverage of the American crimes drew explicit parallels to Jack the Ripper, not only to the crimes themselves, but also to the climate of fear that surrounded them. And this got increasingly lurid over time. There was talk about murder studios, and there were photographs of severed heads and editorials about a madman whose god is the guillotine. And there were a lot of parallels to the Ripper crimes, but there were also troubling inconsistencies in the American crimes. And that's part of what caused such headaches for the investigators. Some of the victims in Cleveland were prostitutes, like the Ripper's victims. But in general, there was no pattern. There were men and women. They were all over the map. And the victims, when they could be identified at all, were found to be drifters or indigents, small-time criminals. But again and again, it came back to the Ripper. One headline said, "Cleveland's torso killer slays in the same manner as Jack the Ripper," which gives you some sense not only of how unprecedented these crimes in America were at the time, but also how people who were reporting on it struggled to find a frame that would even begin to make sense.
The victims, as you say, there didn't seem to be a strong pattern, though the geographic area that was a primary focus was an area called Kingsbury Run, where maybe a lot of down and outs hung out, and there were some bars, and some of these victims may have frequented the same bar at some point in time. And law enforcement was really groping with how to connect these victims.
Yeah, they sure were. As you mentioned, there were many of the crimes appeared to be focusing, centered on this gloomy thread of land in the center of town called Kingsbury Run, which was an ancient dried up riverbed. And it had become a focus of homeless encampments and shanty towns. And at that time, it was really a pretty dismal place. There was a journalist who went down there in the dead of night, and he wrote, "If you enjoy feeling your flesh creep, just take a midnight tour through Kingsbury Run." And that appeared this place, this sort of landscape of cooking fires and shanty towns, and it seemed to have become the killer's hunting ground.
I am talking with Daniel Stashower on his book, American Demon: Eliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper. Before we take a break, let's listen to a bit from the book.
Chapter 6, Woman Slain, Head Sought in Coal Bins. Dismembered parts of approximately half of the body of a woman who had been dead for 2 to 4 days were found yesterday morning in two burlap sacks and a half-bushel basket left in the rear of the Hart Manufacturing Company plant at 2315 East 20th Street. The Plain Dealer, January 27, 1936. Charles Page, owner of the White Front Meat Market on Central Avenue, couldn't understand why anyone would leave a ham outside in the snow. A woman had burst in moments earlier, highly agitated, complaining about the frantic barking of a dog. At the back of the shop, she said she'd found the dog, tied to a fence, howling furiously and straining to get a couple of small bushel baskets. The basket sat at the back wall of a neighboring building, the Hart Manufacturing Company, and they appeared to be filled with parcels of meat. Hams, maybe. Page jumped to his feet. "That sounds like something meat shop burglars might have left behind," he cried. Grabbing his coat, he hurried outside. Page could not have been eager to venture outside on that frigid Sunday morning. A bitter cold snap, the worst in recent memory, had gripped the region and would eventually claim dozens of lives. Page's neighborhood would have felt especially bleak and forbidding. On one side, it was hemmed in by a clattering spur of the Nickel Plate Railroad, with tracks extending through the basin of Kingsbury Run. On the other was a massive Lorraine-Carnegie Bridge, completed 4 years earlier, a series of cantilever truss spans stretching for nearly a mile across the nearby Cuyahoga River. The bridge was anchored at both ends by massive sandstone pylons, 43 feet tall and carved with grim classical figures that glowered over the horizon. Known as the Guardians of Traffic, they each clutched a different vehicle to illustrate progress in transportation, from the stagecoach to the modern automobile. Very little of that progress could be felt in Page's neighborhood, where the streets had been disrupted and realigned to make way for the bridge. What remained was a strange hodgepodge of crumbling factories and sagging houses, with a handful of brothels and betting parlors mixed in. Even under a hard crust of recent snow, the dirt lot behind the meat market looked dingy and forlorn, with a stiff wind rattling the chain-link fence that ran along the far edge. In spite of the snow, Page had no trouble spotting a pair of small woven baskets sitting by the back wall of the Hart Manufacturing Company. The baskets were covered with burlap gunny sacks that had been tugged loose in the wind, revealing neatly packed bundles wrapped in newspaper. Stepping forward, Page reached into one of the baskets and began to unwrap a parcel. Inside was a human arm, severed at the shoulder, alongside a second clump of flesh that appeared to be a section of a thigh. Horrified, Page dropped the parcel and took a step back. Then, unable to stop himself, he bent down and tugged at the corner of one of the burlap gunny sacks. From the gunny sack, the press would report, Mr. Page withdrew the torso, which had been hacked away from the upper body at the region of the stomach, and from which the legs had been clumsily hacked at the beginning of the thighs. At last, Page had seen enough. Dropping the second parcel, he hurried back to his shop to call the police.
From the opening pages of Chapter 6 in Daniel Stashower's American Demon. I am Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear about Dan's personal connection to the story, and about mine as well. Stay with us. I am Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to A Novel Idea. Let's return to my conversation with Daniel Stashower. So let's talk about some of the suspects and a prime suspect that actually was given polygraph tests, and that was in the very, very nascent days of that technology, was Dr. X, Francis Sweeney. So let's focus on him a little bit.
Well, Ness and his team found this suspect, known as Dr. X, that they liked for the crime. He was a doctor who had fallen on hard times, and he had a substance abuse problem. He checked a lot of boxes. We were talking earlier how the investigators believed that the killer must have some kind of medical training. Well, here was a doctor who'd fallen on hard times. Ness's team started trailing Dr. X, and apparently he took a perverse pleasure in it, as if it were some form of hide and seek. There are stories that he even called into police headquarters to taunt Ness and his team on the poor quality of the surveillance effort. He'd say something to the effect of, "That guy you had tailing me wasn't very good. If he wants to try again, I'll be at such and such a department store tomorrow afternoon." Well, at one stage, Ness and his men got incredibly frustrated. They scooped this guy up and they grilled him for a long time in a hotel suite. The details are sketchy and they're contradictory, But one of Ness's colleagues said that the interrogation went on for a week or two in 8-hour stretches. And as you mentioned, he was subjected to polygraph tests, which were not admissible at the time. And the suspect himself knew that they were inadmissible. And Dr. X never cracked. And finally, Ness had to let him go. People are going to argue until the end of time over whether Francis Sweeney, this Dr. X, was the killer, in the same way that people debate over the identity of Jack the Ripper or the grassy knoll in Dallas. And Ness remained alert to the possibility of other suspects, but he seems to have believed that Dr. X was the guy.
And Sweeney had a cousin who was involved in politics, and politics actually did come to play in this story, in the larger story of Elliot Ness, for sure. But there may have been something maybe squelched because of that connection.
That has been a popular theory for quite some time. This suspect had a family connection, a fairly distant one, to a powerful Cleveland congressman of the time. And it's widely believed, at least in some corners, that that may have had a role in at least suppressing the story and his identity, if not derailing the investigation to some extent. But that alone doesn't really account for it. I mean, there are limits to the power of a congressman when there's a series of brutal murders being carried out. But also the absolute blackout silence that Ness and his team observed with respect to this case and their identification continued long after the principals were out of the picture. Ness, in particular, seems to have been very, very sensitive to the fact that he didn't have anything that would stand up in court. He just didn't have any evidence. And Ness had built his career, and particularly his career in Cleveland, on the strength of the criminal evidence that he presented in court. He would gather the evidence, whether it was evidence of police corruption or gambling rings or whatever it was, he would gather the evidence. He would present it to the county prosecutor, a man named Frank Culleton, and Culleton would put him away. That's how it worked. Ness set him up, Culleton put him away. And in this case, Ness just didn't have the cards. He just didn't have the evidence.
There were some other suspects who rose to the top, let's say. One I thought was kind of interesting, that there was a picture put out in the paper of one of the victims, and it was asked for the public to come forward with tips. Does anybody recognize this room and can give us any clues? And a man came forward and said, well, I took that picture. And things didn't end up so good for him in the end. And then there was another suspect, Frank Dolezal, who actually ends up dead. So the zeal for capturing the killer was so great that even these theoretically innocent people were really caught up big time in the investigation, and not to their benefit.
No, and it has to be remembered that this was an era of strong arm policing of the third degree, and bad things happening to criminal suspects in custody. The irony of it is that Elliot Ness had done so much to help modernize these techniques, to help the police techniques, to help the police force move beyond the era of strong arm tactics. But there was still a lot to be done. And in this case, in the Kingsbury Run case investigation, and particularly in those two instances you mentioned, there were real tragedies that occurred as a result of the police struggling with the best of intentions, but resorting to the tactics of an earlier time to get results when the circumstances didn't necessarily support them. In the case of Dolezal, the man you mentioned, that's a pretty terrible illustration of how politics played a role, because a political rival of Ness and Mayor Burton, Ness's boss, a sheriff fastened on this suspect, Frank Dolezal, who under pretty suspicious circumstances was compelled to confess to one of the crimes. And while he was in custody, the police appeared determined to get him to confess to all of the crimes. Well, they worked on him pretty hard, and there are photos of him looking for all the world like he'd been beaten up while in custody. But Dolezal not only didn't confess to the other crimes, he walked back his confession to the original crime, which appeared to have been extracted under duress. It's a pretty shabby episode, and it ends with Dolezal's death under suspicious circumstances while in custody. And that just serves to illustrate how excruciatingly difficult this whole saga was, and some of the depths to which the investigators may have sunk while pursuing it.
We should say that this crime, these crimes, were never really solved. A murderer wasn't held accountable. There are many theories, and you include them in the book. And Elliot Ness, I think we should say, he didn't maybe have the emergent career that he wanted. He ran for office and didn't win. You suggest that he would have loved to be part of the FBI, but J. Edgar Hoover was not a fan of Elliot Ness.
No. The way that appears to have gone is that Hoover was suspicious of anyone who got more or better press than he himself did. And Elliot Ness was getting a great deal of press during the height of the Untouchables era. And then again, when he was the director of public safety in Cleveland, Ness had nothing but respect for the FBI and for Hoover. Ness tried to bring in some of those same techniques, the techniques that Hoover had brought in for his investigators. Ness tried to do much the same in Cleveland, but Hoover remained distrustful of Ness and his motives. But in some ways, Ness was a victim of his own success and bad timing. He remained in his position as director of public safety longer than you might have expected for a job that was a political appointment. But while he was in office, people were always saying to him, you know, Elliot, you should run for mayor. And at the height of his time as director of public safety, he probably would have sailed into the office, but he waited too long. And by the time he did run, his moment had passed, and he went down to a pretty resounding defeat. He was trying by that time to establish himself in the business world, but he didn't have any particular aptitude for it. And he wound up struggling to make ends meet towards the end of his life.
And his fame that came through his biography, or autobiography, I guess that would be, written with another person, and then the subsequent television and movies and everything, that all happened after his death.
Just after his death. Yeah, the famous TV series and the movie were based on a book that was published in 1957. And this was a memoir of the Chicago days, the Untouchables days. And it was written in collaboration with a sports writer named Oscar Fraley. And it's a fun book. It's a great read. It's a potboiler. And the dialogue, you know, it sounds like a gangster flick. There's one line that goes, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like, we walked up to these goons and that one with the shiner started for his Roscoe. There's a lot of stuff like that. And Ness has been slammed over the years for the book's exaggerations and its inventions, but at least some of these exaggerations came from his collaborator, Oscar Fraley. The book can give the impression that Ness saw himself as the central figure in the Capone drama, that he kind of all but lassoed Al Capone from the saddle of a galloping horse. But privately, Ness took a more balanced view. You know, he understood that that he was just one member of the team and that the real work was being done by Treasury agents, the ones who prosecuted Capone on the tax evasion charges. But Ness, it's important to point out, didn't live to see this book published. He died in 1957 of a heart attack, and the book appeared a few months later. He never lived to see himself become a household name.
American Demon, Elliot Ness, and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper, Daniel Stashower. Dan, there is something else I feel I want to ask you about, because you have a family connection to the story, to Elliot Ness, I should say, in a tangential way. And I wonder if you want to talk about that at all.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you for asking. I spent a lot of time looking through Ness's papers and his family scrapbooks, which are in Cleveland. And as you would expect, there are a lot of familiar names and a lot of familiar faces. You see pictures and clippings of Capone and other gangsters, but also some of the era's shining lights like FDR and J. Edgar Hoover and John D. Rockefeller. And there I was, and I'm happily paging through these scrapbooks, and suddenly a face jumps out at me, and it's my grandfather. My grandfather's name was Fred Stashower, and I thought it must be a mistake. Now, I'd love to be able to tell you that my grandfather was a bootlegger or a bank robber or, best of all, a murder suspect, but it turns out that Ness and my grandfather crossed paths at least once a year at a political roast. It was called the Anvil Review, and my grandfather, I came to find out, was a cast member. This was a lot like a Comedy Central roast, or the Gridiron Club. And Ness was a frequent target, one of the goats, as they called them. And apparently Ness took this all in stride and quite liked it. He pasted a caricature of the actors involved into his scrapbook. This included my grandfather. And there was also an audience photo of himself with his hand pressed to his forehead, all but doubled over, laughing at the joke. This was a huge surprise for me. I knew my grandfather for 34 years, long after the Untouchables TV series and even the Kevin Costner movie, and he never mentioned any of this. And it's great to know that Elliot Ness could laugh at himself. The guy may have been untouchable, but he could take a joke. I'd love to be able to talk to my grandfather about it today.
So you began research on this book without that knowledge. You discovered it during the process?
That's right. Yeah, I was already well underway. And as I say, you could have knocked me over. I thought I was dreaming.
I guess that's the 6 degrees of separation.
There you go.
My conversation with Daniel Stashower and his book is American Demon, Elliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper. I am Suzanne Lang. Let's take a short break before we conclude the show, and I'll tell you all about my personal connection to the Torso Murders. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. I'm Suzanne Lang, and like Daniel Stashower, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. I was never aware that Elliot Ness was part of our civic history, nor did I ever hear about these murders, which would have taken place when my dad was just a boy. Not too long ago, a friend of my brother's passed a copy of this book on to him. Within minutes, my brother discovered a shocking bit of information. The first victim that was identified, his name was Edward Andrassy. It turns out that he's my grandmother's cousin. The Andrassys came over from Hungary along with many Hungarians who settled in Cleveland. In fact, Stashower states in his book that in those early years of the last century, there were more Hungarians in Cleveland, Ohio than anywhere outside of Hungary itself. My brother and I thought it strange that the murder of a family member under these circumstances, we thought it might be legendary within our family. But I think it was probably shrouded in shame, though I do recall that my grandmother always had a lot of True Detective magazines around, and my dad would scold us if he caught us flipping through them. Authorities were able to identify Edward Andrassy, where they couldn't identify many of the other victims, through his fingerprints, as he had had a criminal record, though sadly, his head was never recovered. It was this bizarre association to the torso murders that led me to Daniel Stashower and resulted in our conversation on his book. After our formal interview, Dan and I continued kibitzing a bit, and he talks about some more of the victims, so I want to share that with you now as a coda to our conversation. And I may, when I'm putting the show together, talk about my own family connection.
I didn't want to press you on it, but yeah, it is fascinating.
And it's what brought me to your book. I think that our family still wants to do a little bit more digging on this, because, like I said, I'm just shocked, as you were shocked that you didn't hear anything about this from your grandfather, and that I would have thought that this would have been something talked about at some point, or that we would know about it some ways. And I think I'm going to squeeze some of my cousins to see, well, did their dads talk about it?
If you feel they must have, but it's so extraordinary that it, as you'll know from reading the book, there weren't that many victims who were positively identified. There was really only Edward Andrassy and Florence Polillo, and then the Rose Wallace was less ironclad. So a lot of attention was paid to Andrassy, especially in the early days. Although that killing, if I'm remembering the timeline correctly, took place before Ness was on the scene, he came back and spoke to members of the family, people associated with the crime, himself personally. I mean, it was a file that they looked at again and again and again over the course of the investigation, a very important figure in the case.
Yes, that's how they found the negatives. It was on a subsequent visit that they found the negatives of the pictures. I also thought it was very strange, one of the victims, how they essentially posed the head and people were actually coming in person to look at it. It seemed that way, but I thought that was...
Isn't that bizarre? It's like a midnight creep show. That was the tattooed. That was the tattooed man, and you know, as you'll remember, this guy was just covered with this series of very distinctive tattoos. And you would think, well, how could they fail to identify this guy? And it wasn't for lack of trying. They spoke to tattoo artists all across the country, nothing turned up. And then they get that scheme to display the head, you know, carefully propped up on a towel in the city morgue, as if it were a midnight horror show. I mean, can you imagine?
Just crazy.
Yeah.
No, I can't imagine at all, in fact. But how fun was it doing research for this book?
Well, I have to say that the crimes themselves got under my skin in a big way. It was a horrifying story where the crimes themselves are involved directly. But doing the research into life in Cleveland in the 1930s was really fun. And particularly this sense that I was seeing it through my grandfather's eyes and reading about what was going on in the newspapers and getting a sense of the city on its way up. I don't know how long you lived there or when, but when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, it was a big deal that the river had caught fire. It was a tough time to be a Clevelander. People will remember Rowan and Martin's laugh in and how the city had become this all-purpose punchline. And a lot of that was built around the river having caught fire in June of 1969. Well, I'm looking through this microfilm in the Cleveland newspapers from the 1930s. Sure enough, there's a piece about the Cuyahoga River catching fire. It had also happened in 1936. And the response in 1936 was completely different from what happened in 1969. Nobody was especially happy that the river caught fire, far from it. But there was also a feeling like, look, we're a city on the move. You have to break some eggs to make an omelet. We'll get that cleaned up. Don't worry. And the Cleveland News even suggested maybe the photos of the river on fire ought to be sent to Ripley's, believe it or not. They ran this headline that said, Mr. Ripley, our river's on fire. I'm not suggesting that anybody thought that setting fire to the Cuyahoga was a good idea, but I liked the way the city doubled down on it. The sense that, look, here we go, we're on our way up. These things happen.
When I read that in the book, I thought, what? And I had to do a little research on that myself because it was so intriguing to me. And I too loved the Cleveland aspect of it because that's when my dad was growing up and I kept imagining my dad, he would talk about riding his bike all over Cleveland. And when you would talk about those young boys discovering the bodies, I thought
Could have been your dad, absolutely.
could have been my dad for as much as they got around. And yeah, Cleveland was a city really rising up at that time. So as a Clevelander, and you just only have to go blocks before you find another Cleveland expatriate. So I hope there's a lot of interest because I thought it was a good Cleveland story too.
And I have to say, I've had exactly the same experience as you have about, that you find people from Cleveland everywhere you look. I have a joke when I'm talking about the book at libraries and things like that. I'll say, this story begins as all great stories do in Cleveland, Ohio. And there's always some people in the audience who cheer, who are there because it's a Cleveland story and they're proud Clevelanders.
You can move away, but
Yeah, that's right.
you still have that identity. You still have that identity. And so, anyway, well, very nice talking to you today.
Great. Thanks so much.
All right. Really enjoyed it. Hey, are you working on something else right now?
I'm working on something. I'm writing proposals and trying to get something else up and running. I like this part of it, but I don't know what it's going to be. I can only tell you that I've promised my wife that there will be fewer dismemberments in the next story, whatever it is. And I feel that's a promise I can hardly fail to keep.
Right. Absolutely. Well, all the best. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Suzanne. It's been a pleasure.
Daniel Stashower and I talking about his book, American Demon: Eliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper. I enjoyed talking with Dan because of my own odd personal connection with the story, but in the future, I hope to talk with him or any other author without the connection of a headless victim. I am Suzanne Lang. We have production assistance from Will Penny, Mark Prell, and Max Allen. Our music is from Peter Jacobson. The reading from American Demon was performed by Michael O'Brien. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Stream us online, listen to past shows, and subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.